as the world watches and waits,
there is still no plan from Europe to stop the spreading debt crisis.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. It is the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Friday, September 16th. Happy Friday, Steve.
Happy Friday, Jeremy. Coming up, remember the president's job creation plan? One economist says don't bother. It's not going anywhere.
How do you put a number on how consumers are feeling?
Later, a potato chip vending machine, Jeremy, that doesn't take change, only spuds. Take your potatoes with you. That story and others on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is in Poland today, cheering on European finance ministers who are trying to sort through the European debt crisis. Those ministers have delayed any more action on bailouts for countries with severe debt problems, Greece, Steve, until next month. And we just found out today that the so-called rogue trader who allegedly caused $2 billion worth of losses at the Swiss bank UBS has been charged with fraud.
Yeah, that was a big story. Meanwhile, the economy on this side of the Atlantic continues to sputter. Jobs are nowhere to be found, yet the stock market has been on a bit of a rally. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch, and she's with us from New York, as she is every Friday morning. Hey, Jill.
Good morning.
So we've already been through one financial crisis. Has enough been done, do you think, in Europe to stop the next one?
Well, I always like to think of Europe as a sick patient, and the central banks have now treated some of the short-term symptoms of the patient's illness, but they really haven't cured the big problem, the spreading disease of debt, and that's the one that infects Greece, Spain, Italy, and Portugal. Until they develop the cure for the larger problem, again, till probably not till October, our patient is in ICU.
So the short answer is no. We're waiting until October, as I mentioned earlier, for more answers. More uncertainty, I'm sure. I mean, how's that going to affect the American economy?
Well, let's use our sick patient analogy again. When your relative's sick, you don't plan a big vacation, right? So right now, U.S. companies are holding back on making plans, whether that means hiring new employees or embarking on big expansions. I think the economy is going to probably stay in a pretty bad holding pattern here at this low level.
Everyone being cautious.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So we've had all this caution and 4 days in a row of stocks going up. I mean, with all the bad news going on, what's got everyone on Wall Street so excited?
Well, let's not forget that as much as we like to use computers, investors are human beings, and we are swayed by emotions. And, you know, just think, you're so happy to hear that the doctor comes out and says the patient is stable. But, you know, it's only in the short term. Remember what happened in 2008 and 2009. The U.S. government injected our sick banking system with a massive dose of TARP. That definitely stabilized the patient. It didn't prevent a lot of suffering in March of 2009 when stocks bottomed out again.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a bumpy ride. And I think you may be happy about this week, but you know what? It's going to keep happening until we get to the core issue, which is solving the debt crisis.
Get it by its root.
You got it.
Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch in New York. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
Let's get another take on the European debt crisis now with Mark Cliff. He is chief economist with ING, and he joins us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I feel like there's a little deja vu quality to this. So we start the week talking about everyone losing confidence in Europe and its banking system. We end the week with a big meeting and all the leaders saying everything's going to be fine. Is it different this time?
Not really. No, unfortunately. I think we're going to see this saga running and running. There's a lot of ideas floating around, but there's not really a unity of purpose or indeed an agreement on precisely the way forward.
There's been a lot of talk about Greece potentially having to leave because it's pretty much just too much of a drag on the rest of Europe. Do you think that Europe is going to look the same a year from now as it does today?
I think that's pretty unlikely. Obviously, there's a lot of speculation about the inevitability of default in Greece and indeed the possibility of other countries defaulting and even some countries leaving the Eurozone entirely. I think we will probably see some kind of managed default at some point, but I think it's extremely unlikely that any country will be allowed to leave because the consequences are well, extremely unpalatable. And I think in the end, the politicians will find some way of avoiding that. But this isn't going to happen quickly.
Mark Cliff is chief economist with ING. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been more than a week since President Obama laid out his job creation plan to Congress. He's been out and about across the country saying lawmakers should pass his $447 billion package as is.
But just this morning, the Republican House Majority Leader Eric Cantor said, as he's been saying for the last few days, that he rejects the president's, quote, all or nothing approach on the jobs bill. And some Democrats have been critical as well. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Chris, opposition growing. Are economists like you expecting this jobs plan to go anywhere?
I'm not. There will be bits and pieces of it that make it through, I'm sure. But there's so much opposition in Washington, and it's not just the Republicans. As you said, there are some Democrats in the Senate particularly who are uncomfortable with the tax break on Social Security taxes because they say it sets up Social Security to be the fall guy for budget cuts down the road.
So if we don't get a big package on jobs in the near future, what happens to the economy?
Well, I'm more than a little nervous about that because the economy is still growing, but it's growing very close to stall speed, which means we're vulnerable to a shock pushing us back into recession. I think ultimately it increases the odds we see further stimulus from the Federal Reserve to keep things going.
And Chris, quickly, you know, there are people who obviously would feel it if nothing gets passed who are unemployed. But what about for those people who are employed? Would they feel a dip in the economy if nothing gets passed?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're seeing continuously slower growth in income. It's a real squeeze, and it seems to be falling primarily on the middle class.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. Thanks, as always.
Thank you.
We love it when you download and subscribe to the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast. It makes you sort of like family, Jeremy, right?
It's right. And it makes us happy. But you know what we don't get enough of from our family on the other side of the podcast? We don't get enough of your reaction. We want to know
feedback.
What you think,
we
what you like.
Feedback. Absolutely.
We want to know also what you don't like.
Yeah. Which you will tell us, I'm sure. You can subscribe to the podcast, obviously. We'd love for you to keep getting it day in and day out. But also comment on it. Give it 5 stars or 3 stars or whatever you say.
And, no, 5 stars.
Yeah,
would be good.
Okay, give it 5 stars. Forget about the 3 stars. I never said that. And even recommend it to a friend. That's a great idea, too.
Or tell them to stay away from it.
Don't do it. Don't do it, man.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Consumer sentiment in this country nudged up in early September, but the Thomson Reuters University of Michigan survey shows people don't feel very good about what's to come. Consumer expectations fell to its lowest level, Jeremy, in 31 years, since May of 1980.
I can't believe that number. That is just really unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
And while those figures give us an idea of how people are handling the lackluster economy, Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports it's tough putting numbers on a feeling.
Economists like Chris Christopher of IHS Global Insight use words like sentiment and confidence to measure something that's pretty hard to measure.
When you talk about confidence, it's a somewhat of a mystical thing.
Like a fortune teller, Christopher predicts what the sentiment numbers will be and then uses those to predict the retail sales that'll follow. And he's been doing it for years. He says small swings in confidence mean little.
But large swings downward or upward, like we saw over the summer, tell you that something's going to give.
Look, there's lies, there's damn lies, and then there's economic data, okay?
Doug Bechtel is a demographer with the University of Georgia. He says the numbers out today are based on a relatively small sample, around 500 telephone surveys. Then there's the way they're interpreted.
One person from one school could view the economy going one way, and another person with another theoretical approach could view it headed in the opposite direction.
I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
We can blame a lot of things for contributing to the weakness of the housing market. Too many houses, too few jobs, banks that are unwilling to lend money to people who want to buy. But LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus says we should also blame the title insurance industry. David, good morning.
Good morning.
So first, explain what title insurance is.
Well, it's essentially a product that allows the lender to know that the property is yours, that there haven't been any changes in your life, that there are no liens against the property, and the lender can then proceed with confidence that everything's on the up and up.
Okay, so what's the problem? How is title insurance holding us back from a healthy housing market?
Well, the problem is that a lot of people are refinancing within a relatively short space of time, oftentimes within a single year. And as a result, they're asking, well, wait a minute, why do I have to pay full freight again on the title insurance when somebody has checked these records just a few months ago?
So when you refinance your loan, you're having to pay for a brand new title insurance?
Exactly. Now, title insurance companies say this is fully fair because they can't know what has happened to your property even days after the last refi, and they have a good point there. On the other hand, we need to be a little reasonable about this. If a title company is doing a search of public records within a relatively short space of time, much of its work has already been done. And that's why title companies routinely will offer discounts of 20% or more for a second refi within a short space of time, because even they are conceding that it's not as hard to do this the second time around.
So what can people who have to dabble in the world of title insurance do?
Shop around. It turns out that the various title companies offer different rates for these services, often varying by hundreds of dollars. So make sure your mortgage broker or your real estate professional shops around for the best deal. And then if you are refinancing within a relatively short space of time, ask about the discounts. Oftentimes, title companies aren't very forward in saying, oh, yes, we'll provide the discounts unless you ask. So make sure your broker does that.
Thanks for giving us another thing to worry about, David.
Always here to help.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Shares of Research in Motion, the maker of the BlackBerry, have been down 20% in early trading today since news came out about sales of its tablets that were less than half what analysts were expecting. Smartphone sales haven't been doing well either. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
It used to be BlackBerry was the business smartphone, but that started to change. Now companies are outfitting employees with the Apple iPhone and smartphones that run on the Android operating system.
People have been enticed by the touch screens and then, of course, the accessibility and usability of the app stores.
That's Rachel Lashford. She's a telecom analyst with Canalys in Singapore. While the market changed, Research in Motion was reluctant to change its product. Analyst Adam Leach is with Ovum in London.
The BlackBerry smartphones were in the market. The portfolio that RIM were relying on was getting quite old and really needed a refresh.
RIM has started to do just that. Too late for the second quarter, but Rachel Lashford says new products bode well for the company. Reports of RIM's demise, she says, are premature.
Still a top five player, and it's still shipping significant volumes worldwide.
To South America and to countries like South Africa and the UK. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Steve, you know those surveys that tell us how much work time we lose to Facebook
and
Twitter
and
the NCAA basketball tournament pools and everything else?
Yeah.
Well, there's a new survey out that says American companies lose $1.5 billion in productivity because employees are playing the game Angry Birds for 200 million minutes a day.
Now,
I don't know where they come up with these numbers. Have you ever played that game?
You've played
it's
that game
fun.
Before.
No, yeah, it's definitely fun, but... But where do they come up with these numbers? $1.5 billion, 200 million minutes a day. I mean, it seems a bit arbitrary. I would like to see a survey about how much money that these surveys are costing the economy in terms of lost productivity.
$14 trillion.
$14.3 trillion, I think.
Now to the world's biggest retailer, Walmart. When the company does something, even if it's as small as changing which brand of light bulbs it sells, it has huge implications. Well, now, as Marketplace's Eve Tro reports, Walmart is giving a solar energy company a big boost.
Walmart sees renewable energy as a way to save money. Joel McCower at greenbiz.com says long-term contracts for solar power insulate Walmart from roller coaster prices on the grid.
They can lock in lower energy prices. They can predict their electricity costs years out from now.
Walmart's banking heavily on SolarCity, a company that uses emerging technology in thin solar film instead of traditional solar panels. Next week, SolarCity and Walmart will expand their partnership. Lawrence Gassman at Nano Markets says Walmart does take on risk by backing a newish technology, but it's a different kind of risk than government loans.
They make judgment calls based entirely on profit, whereas the government is trying to do some stuff which has to do with jobs, which is a much harder way to do investment.
SolarCity just landed a big loan guarantee from the government, $344 million, as part of a deal to put solar power on military housing. Gassman says the solar industry now attracts enough private money that the government guarantees are not essential, but federal subsidies are crucial for growth. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
It was a record summer for the film industry. Box office receipts topped $4.4 billion. No thanks to me, Steve. I don't think I've seen a movie all summer.
I haven't
seen
a movie. No, I saw a couple of them. I saw a Will Ferrell flick not too long ago. I remember
which
that.
Which one?
The one where he's out on the lawn, he gets kicked out of the house. It was actually very sad.
I think that's every single Will Ferrell movie.
No, this was a different...
This is a new one. All right, well, some of the year's blockbusters got a little help from the Science and Entertainment Exchange, created by the National Academy of Sciences that pairs scientists with Hollywood. More on that collaboration now from Marketplace's Adrian Hill.
Matching up Hollywood producers and writers with scientists isn't without its, shall we say, hurdles.
I think at the beginning there was this sneaking suspicion that the science people thought maybe they weren't quite cool enough to hang out with the Hollywood people.
Ann Merchant is with the nonprofit National Academy of Sciences.
And the Hollywood people were maybe just a little intimidated by, oh my gosh, does that guy have a Nobel Prize and I'm just hanging out with him?
But they got over it. The exchange is basically a free matchmaking service, and it's popular. They do 3 to 5 new consults every week. One film that used the exchange, the summer blockbuster Thor.
And I know that it isn't necessarily intuitive that there would be science with Norse gods, because that was my first reaction.
There's a couple of ways in which science became important in Thor.
Sean Carroll at the California Institute of Technology was one of the scientists who helped out. Among other things, Thor's creators wanted to know,
what is a way that a super advanced civilization could zoom around great distances through the galaxy very quickly?
His answer made it straight to the movie, more or less.
You don't think this was just a magnetic storm, do you?
Look, the lensing around these edges is characteristic of an Einstein-Rosen bridge.
A what?
My question exactly. Turns out it's a sciencey word for a wormhole, but...
I was told by the producer, Kevin Feige, you know, we can't call it a wormhole. That's too 90s. But it's clearly the idea they wanted, so I said, well, you know, you could call it an Einstein-Rosen bridge.
The exchange isn't trying to turn Hollywood blockbusters into snoozy documentaries. It's not trying to make every piece of fantastical worlds realistic. It's not trying to directly preach or teach science.
I don't have any illusions of grandeur that Einstein-Rosen bridge is now in the teenage lexicon for kids everywhere.
Rick Lovert is the director of development for the exchange.
You know, if that can inspire one kid to go look it up on Wikipedia and get interested in theoretical physics, then we're doing our job.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
And finally, supermarkets in Argentina, Jeremy, are getting some vending machines that'll sell you Lay's potato chips. I love potato chips, right?
Yeah. Big,
nice
Sounds
snack.
Like a good idea.
But the machines don't take coins. They take potatoes. You put the spud in there, in the slot.
You put a potato into the machine.
Yeah, you buy the potato from the grocery store, and then you put the potato in the slot of the machine, and you watch this video of the whole chip-making process, right? The washing of the potato and the peeling of it and the slicing of it, and then the frying of it, right? It goes into the oil and then they salt it and then they put it in the bag.
I feel like you've seen this video a few times.
I have, as a matter of fact. And voila, out comes a warm bag of Lay's potato chips, right? Lay's, of course, wants you to know that these chips are made from real potatoes. But remember, you watch a video of it. You don't watch the process of it in the machine. So the machine is not actually making your potato chips. So the bag of chips you just bought, yeah, not from that potato. It was in there the entire time.
I would love to know what they do with all the potatoes that are collected.
I don't know. Something tells me they put them right back in the produce department, but I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Sell them back to the store.
Yeah, sell them back to the store, exactly. What a great business model. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
Have a great weekend. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.